Welcome to For the Love of Jewelers, a podcast brought to you by Rio Grande Jewelry Supply and hosted by yours truly, Courtney Gray. As we dive into season four in 2023, we recognize the relevance and resilience of the jewelry industry through stories of inspiration. We celebrate the pivots we've taken and the passion that drives our unconditional strength. Our journey, although uncharted, is one we are on together. Join me as we discover the variety of silver linings in each story of innovation and determination. Monica Stevenson is the founder of gemstone company Anza Gems. Anza Gems fuels development in Kenya and Tanzania through responsible gemstone purchasing, with 10% of sales supporting education and entrepreneurial initiatives in mining communities. She is a founding collaborator with NGOs PACT and the Tanzania Women Miners Association of Moyo Gems, which offers a traceable, supportive model to bring gems from women artisanal miners of Tanzania and Kenya to the international market. Monica is the president of the Board of Ethical Metalsmiths and is on the International Board of Directors of the Women's Jewelry Association, the Board of Directors for Gem Legacy, and an advisory member of the Black and Jewelry Coalition. Let's dive in. Hi, guys. Welcome back to For the Love of Jewelers. I have with us today Monica Stevenson, founder of Anza Gems. She is the current president of the Board of Ethical Metalsmiths and collaborator on Moyo Gems. Welcome, Monica.
Thank you for having me, Courtney. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I do love that we can do this from different states and connect and kind of stay together virtually. It's really, we're kind of lucky. I can't remember life without this.
One of the benefits to come out of COVID, I think.
Yes, as everybody said, okay, time to get over it, get on camera, do what we got to do to stay together and continue the collaborations that we've started. And you are, I just am so impressed, Monica, looking at everything that you've been serving, all these initiatives, all the organizations that you're on the board of. I'm seriously, how do you keep up with all of this? Teach us your ways.
That's a really good question. And some days I kind of question, am I keeping up with everything? But I've kind of figured out a way to kind of compartmentalize my time a little bit and kind of work on some things independently, but I'm also benefit from the affiliation of all of these different very disparate parts of my life are actually really kind of knit together quite well. There's a lot of synergy with all of the different organizations and also with my companies as well. It's kind of just, it's my life actually. So yes, I'm not very good with boundaries, and yes, I work until far too late. And there's, you know, that whole COVID thing of like, what is work and what is home? It doesn't really exist anymore. I'm also a mom. So that's, you know,
you are
another part of that equation. But, you know, at the end of the day, at the end of the week, maybe not everything gets done, but there's progress. There's always progress.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm reading a book right now called Atomic Habits, and it's all about that 1% each day. You know, just shifting things or working towards whatever the goal is. Anyway, that's exciting. How many kids?
Two girls. Yeah, one in college and one sophomore in high school.
Ah.
So I'm busy, but maybe not quite as busy as I was when kids were little. So
yeah, it shifts and changes, doesn't it?
Yes, yeah. It does.
I have one driving now, which is terrifying, but also kind of wonderful because he can pick up the other one.
It's one of those, and things. It is terrifying and it's liberating, right? At the
yes.
same time. There's a lot of those things in life. You just have to embrace it.
Yeah, absolutely. The one thing we can count on is things are always going to change, right? And move around. Yeah.
Especially with kids, especially with business, you know, you just never know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Staying bendy, staying malleable, right?
Yes.
So tell us a little bit, Monica. I'm curious about why jewelry industry. Where did you know? Give us a little backstory on your world and how you came to all this work.
Sure. And I have to warn you that going from a girl from the Midwest to standing on the edge of a gem mine in Kenya is quite a journey, right? So it's not linear. I have been in the industry for I stopped counting at 25 years because I felt like that started to make me look a little too experienced, perhaps. But let's just suffice it to say it's more than 25 years. And I had a rather non-traditional journey to college. So it took me a couple of years to get to university. And when I did, I worked full time. And I happened to work in a jewelry store that was actually like an American Gem Society, really beautiful store with kind of at the forefront of designer jewelry. And I was an art history major and was very involved in fine arts. And so for me, it was a natural extension. Oh, this is jewelry is sculpture, really. So it is art. And I was very fortunate to kind of have that background, and that was my first real foray into jewelry. And much like a lot of people in the industry, I was completely hooked, and hook, line, and sinker, absolutely 100% all in, and never realized that this would kind of be my path. But I have had a number of different experiences over the years. I started an internet business in the late 90s. I helped Amazon launch their jewelry business in the early 2000s. So I had this kind of like straddling of jewelry and tech. But when my kids were little, which was just after the Amazon launch, I really wasn't able to kind of immerse myself in quite the same way. Retail nor tech are really very, kid-friendly professions. And so I ended up starting the iDazzle.com blog, which I kind of chronicled stories of jewelry designers and trends and just directional things in the industry. And it kept me involved in a way that I could do that even with small children.
Yeah. Again, staying malleable, right?
Staying malleable. Okay. That this is my way of kind of keeping my toe in and kind of really taking a look at things. And what happened was I found myself more and more drawn to stories about responsibility in the industry. People who were kind of forging a different path and really taking into account maybe all of the supply chain. And I found myself really intrigued with those conversations and those interviews and those profiles, because there's only kind of so many times you can say something is sparkly or beautiful. For me, it kind of shifted the conversation to one of purpose. There were people who had found kind of this like calling or purpose in the industry. And so I found myself more and more drawn to those stories. And then there was this opportunity to go to East Africa with a documentary film and kind of trace the journey of a gemstone from the mine, the red dirt in East Africa, all the way through to the end consumer. And for some reason, I was just unaccountably intrigued. And it was pretty random. I mean, to be clear, I had dealt with gems before. I'd worked in every facet of the industry, but the idea of seeing a source community was like so compelling to me. I can't explain it except that I had to go. So I actually, knew no one on this trip. I traveled 9,000 miles and found myself, at the edge of a Savorite mine in Kenya. Wow. Wondering, what am I doing?
How did I get here?
So, like I said, not linear at all. But what I found was just incredibly moving. And I was also really struck by the idea that these East Africans are so involved digging these gems out of the ground, but yet have very little visibility in the industry, very little, visibility, very little access to things like education and financing and tools and resources that's really the main cause of the gap between how the lack of participation and the end of the chain, which I had always been kind of involved in. So it was really eye-opening for me, and my business model for Onza Gems was born from that trip. It took me a little while to kind of figure out that this is the direction that I want to go, but I created Onza Gems after that trip.
So right away, you were just like, okay, here's the path.
And, you know, there's always this little bit of naivety with, you know, some of these projects, like knowing what I know.
We can do anything.
Yeah. Knowing what I know now, I'm like, huh, that was bold. That was
right?
A bold move. But at the time, it just made perfect sense to me because I wanted to create a circular business model. So something that would address the lack of access and resources at the beginning of the chain. So my business model is that I go to East Africa, usually, you know, pre-COVID, a couple of times, 2 to 3 times a year. I buy rough gems at from miners and dealers there. And then I have them cut in the US, which is a little bit unusual, but I choose to kind of support US artisanal cutters who then fashion the gemstones into beautiful, mostly one-of-a-kind creations. And then those gems are sold to designers and retailers all over the world who, for whatever reason, it really resonates with them, this somewhat shortened supply chain. And 10% of sales goes back into initiatives that are education-based, entrepreneurial, community development, back in the mining regions of East Africa. So I kind of like approach it as, you know, give back in order to kind of try to kind of create that more level playing field.
Yeah. I like how you describe it as circular.
That was an important part of my model. And what really resonated so clearly for me when I took that trip, I also came into contact with schools, orphanages, a few other kinds of, you know, a faceting school in Arusha, where I knew that this 10% could go to. So it wasn't just sending checks to Africa. It is actually going to specific initiatives that I know the people involved, there are local partners, and there's accountability for those funds.
Sounds like a lot to keep track of. You guys have a group or community here that's working together.
So a vertical business is always kind of challenging, right? So you have, you know, I literally have to manage every single piece of the business from, you know, buying the rough to export to faceting. And then, by the way, we document all of these journeys too. So we photograph the rough, we photograph the faceted, we know precisely who the cutter is. So it's, you know, there is a lot of work that goes in to it. And it's also not easy work. Like, there's nothing, people ask me all the time, oh, what's your biggest challenge? I'm like, pretty much all of it. Like, you know, I can't even count on the export process being clean and simple and straightforward. But in the end, you know, having that beautiful product that you can kind of tell that story is worth it.
Yeah. So it's worth all the time and labor. And I absolutely loved, you know, digging in and looking at the miners and seeing, I mean, I kind of want to jump ahead to Moyo at this point and talk a little bit about these women miners.
Yeah, it's a perfect segue. So I proceeded to make, like, after that first trip, I've made, I don't know, 16 more trips to East Africa. And in those trips, I usually it wasn't just to like meet with brokers in an office in Arusha. Yes, that's part of it. But I would also pick at least one or two mining villages, communities, regions to go to and actually travel and go to the mines, go into the mines if possible, shake people's hands, have a conversation and kind of find out what are their challenges. Like what would you like to see the market kind of help you and support you? And in those journeys, I would see women and sometimes a fair amount of women, but always on the periphery, always on the edges. You know, they're mining the tailings of the men's mines, the local men's mines, or they're feeding the miners. You know, that's their income. But there's a lot of women in the supply chain that are pretty much invisible. So I heard about this initiative from GIA, where Gemological Institute of America was doing an artisanal mining training. And they had these booklets that had been prepared in a lot of photos. Some of the miners are illiterate. They are, you know, working very hard, but they maybe haven't had as much access to education. So the book was either in pictures or Swahili and English, and really it really resonated with me. I was like, this is precisely what they need. GIA extension classes with microscopes isn't really where the miners were kind of, they need the education. They need to know what the minerals are that they're digging up. And in many cases, there's a huge lack of education. They're bagging everything together. They are, selling it for the lowest common denominator to the lowest bidder. And so when I saw this GIA approach of step one is to kind of educate them about what they're finding and how to bring it to market, it really resonated. Also, they were targeting the Tanzania Women Miners Association members as their pilot project in Tanga, Tanzania. And I'd been there several times at this point. I visited with some women miners there. So the impact of this project instantly resonated for me. I completely understood that this was a game changer. And I was so excited. I started talking to Christina Villegas of PACT. And that's a worldwide NGO that focuses on artisanal mining communities around the world in different minerals. And they were helping GIA kind of execute this program. Mm-hmm. I was like, well, this is fantastic. But who's bringing their gems to market? You know, like, is there a market for their gems? And she said, well, you know, GIA doesn't really do, you know, commercial trade. PACT doesn't do that. So I was like, hey, I know a few people who I think that we could make a market here for these women's gems. And so this conversation kind of all came to be at the Chicago Responsible Jewelry Conference in 2017.
Okay.
And it was Stuart Poole of 1948. He's a gem dealer based in the UK. And Christina and myself, and actually there's a blockchain component. And we all decided that let's go travel to Tanzania to these women, and let's actually engage in a dialogue and see what they want, what they need from a market. It was really eye-opening. It was wonderful to kind of have these conversations. That was in 2018. And based on those conversations, that's kind of how we built and, sort of executed this marketplace that we now call Moyo Market Days.
So I can't imagine, like, I just want to come with you, Monica. Let's get on a plane.
You should.
I would love that. Yeah. I bet it's so enlightening. I mean, just the differences of the culture, for one, I'm so intrigued by, and then just the function and the ability that the tools that they have access to are so much more scarce, I guess. And I was reading, you know, it's like literally a hammer and a shovel, right?
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
So you're in the dirt. You are digging these gemstones up, and they half the time didn't even know what they were finding.
Correct.
I find that so interesting.
So working, you know, there's not a lot of infrastructure in these regions. These are pretty rural areas. You know, it's probably anywhere from 3 to 5 hours to the nearest like town. So it's quite remote, and they're working with suboptimal, you know, tools and things. And so we really wanted to do more than just buy their gems. We really want to empower them as business people and as, you know, autonomous members of their community to participate in the same way that their male counterparts could. And also just artisanal miners in general are pretty marginalized to begin with. And then women are even more so. They lack even more access to necessities. And so we actually kind of created a few parameters around the program that they, for their own, you know, knowledge, they should take the GIA program training. Mm-hmm. So they had to have participated in that. They need to be members of the Tanzania Women Miners Association. They also, we arranged for occupational health and safety training to be done for free in their villages before the first market days. So again, maybe like a little bit of knowledge of how to mine better, how to mine safer. There's still a lot of work to be done, but those were, and legality, we also wanted to make sure that they had mining licenses to kind of protect their own interests Otherwise, they're really at the mercy of the landowners, whoever controls that land that they're mining. They don't own that land. Right. They just have mining permissions. So we really wanted to make sure that there was a base level of legality. So starting with kind of those building blocks, we really wanted to kind of scaffold them into understanding their value, understanding what they're worth, and giving them an outlet for their gemstones that they have not had before.
And the parameters for marketplace. So it's, I was thinking of this in terms of listening to a talk with, I think Linus Drogs was on it, from MJSA. They did the virtual talks this year. Andrea Hill, I think, was hosting. And one of the questions, one of the ways they described it was kind of farm to table, which I really enjoyed that analogy. It just made sense. And I think it may make sense to everyone as we begin to understand more about sourcing and understanding traceability and where things are coming from. So you're literally there with the miner and then providing a way for them to take it to market or to table, basically.
Yeah, that is a great analogy. And, you know, we have that kind of traceability with, I mean, to some extent with like the tomato you buy at the market or, you know, the food that you eat. So, you know, certain things, we actually do have that traceability. So this is not, you know, it's not rocket science to have this kind of radical transparency, but it takes, you know, that extra effort and work to actually kind of document and have assurances. And that's why we have NGOs involved. We have PACT involved. We have TWOMA, the Tanzania Women Miners Association. You know, we involve the government of Tanzania as a stakeholder because we want that accountability as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're trying to kind of build this system where it's normalizing the fact that we can name a miner when you buy a gemstone. That is very radical and very unusual. It's not the only initiative where this is happening, but I think it is a definitely a movement away from the opacity that the industry has kind of embraced up to this point.
Yeah, it's exciting and very, very interesting. Yeah, I guess one of the things that blew me away was the TWOMA. There's 3,300 members.
Yeah.
Am I saying that right? TWOMA?
I think that's right. And I'm not sure if that might be throughout the country. And
yeah,
they're
okay.
They're just a very organized, you know, NGO themselves. So they are, you know, they kind of lobby their government for on behalf of the miners, and they really have a huge representation, like a huge stake in this. Most of the it's run by women,
right?
Especially in the region that we work in, which is Tonga, Tanzania, which is kind of the northern. It kind of borders the coastline and borders Kenya, and very gem rich area. I cannot believe the bounty of what comes out of the ground there. It is truly staggering to me every single time that I'm able to go and actually sit at the market table. It's really remarkable. And it's a very strong organization throughout the country, but it happens to have a very strong representation in this region, which, given how rural and how isolated this region is, it's quite remarkable.
Yeah. I'm curious why so many women miners in that particular, is the Umba Valley?
Umba Valley.
In Tanzania. Yeah. I was curious, is that like the only work that there is there, or what, why do you think that is?
That's interesting. So I think, again, a lot of people, when I introduce myself and what I do, they're shocked about, wait, women are mining? And I think part of that is just how invisible they are in the overall global gemstone community, right? You just don't hear stories about this. I wouldn't say that there's like a majority of women miners, but I've heard some estimates that in this region, it's about 30% women are miners, maybe 25 to 30. So it's hard to get really accurate numbers on that, but I would say that based on anecdotally traveling there, and also the facts and figures from NGOs, like I think it's around 30%. So it's not a majority, but it is definitely a thriving, you know, part of the market. And again, I think most of the time it's invisible. And in some regions, that's not as common. So it does happen to be in East Africa in general that you see, you know, that about that percentage of women. And you're right, there's not a lot of other options for employment. So, and let me stress too that this is artisanal and small-scale mining in this region. There's very few, if any, really large organized mines that would have, you know, hundreds of employees and a mine manager and mine employees. These are all independent, you know, contractors, essentially. They're okay. All independent entities. They file for their own licenses, or they have group cooperative licenses, which we also encourage because, again, it's organization, but it's also taking some of the burden off of the administrative part of things if you share that. But there's a lot of, you know, it's hand tools, it's holes in the ground. There's not a lot of mechanization. There's no electricity in most of these villages. There's wow. no running water or very little running water. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about very like the kind of, you know, I would say the most bare examples of artisanal mining.
Wow. Yeah. Do you have a, well, guys, I'm going to encourage you all out there listening to go and read the stories of these miners, and just the images makes me want to go there and just meet some of these women miners. They just look amazing, like full of life and spirit and walking miles and miles, you know, hours to get to these mines and camping out together. So go read the stories. And I bet you wrote all of those, didn't you, Monica?
No.
Did you write a lot of them?
No, we asked them what their stories are and then, you know, make sure to try to translate. And if you see photos of the women, we've gotten photo releases from all of them. Like, we're very responsible in even, you know, and not extractive even about how we tell their stories. Like, it's only if they want to tell their stories. We try to use their words. We actually... You know, again, they need to agree that they're okay being photographed and having those photographs reproduced. This is their story. This is their lives. And there's a reason why we, like, their resilience is just incredible. The reason we focus on women is that when you benefit women, the entire community will benefit. There's a ripple effect to everything. So now they're able to pay their kids' school fees, and then they're able to buy the food that they need for their families. And so all of those things kind of support others in the community as well. And so the ripple effect is really, really large, and impact is huge. So that's why we chose to center the market around women. Certainly all artisanal miners in this region need help, need all the support that they can get. We just happen to choose women to kind of focus on first because there's a huge community benefit to that.
Yeah, I love how you explain that. That makes total sense. Like, nurture the mothers, nurture the provider, take care of the top, and that trickles down, ripples out.
And most of these women are caregivers up and down the chain, right? So the fact that we're bringing the market to them, access is one of their biggest issues, right? So they are miles and miles from the nearest town. So they are at the mercy of kind of the local broker to sell their gemstones when they find it. And traditionally, brokers fulfill a very important part in the chain of getting gems to market. And they are also microfinancers in a way. And so the idea that they don't know what they're going to sell that gem for. So if a woman comes to them and she's mined this pocket of gems, and it's a subsistence economy, she needs to sell those gems in order to feed her family, buy school supplies, whatever it might be. And needs are very pressing for her. So she will take whatever he gives her, and he, you know, has to keep in mind, like, it's garnets or it's sapphires. It's willing buyer, willing seller. This is not diamonds or gold where there's like an actual commodity value to it. So he gives her some money. It might be the equivalent of pennies on the dollar. So, you know, in Tanzanian shillings, of what I will ultimately pay in a, you know, an export office in Arusha, because that gem will change hands, you know, 10 times in country before it gets to me as the international dealer. And so a lot of people are making money at every single one of these transactions, except for the miner who actually is the one who dug it out of the ground. And I think that's my biggest, that was my biggest takeaway years ago when I started Anza and again with Moyo, is this idea of let's redistribute that wealth a little bit. There's plenty of money being made on these gems in the market. How about the miner gets a little bit more of that? And so, you know, we've kind of created this radical transparency of the miner, but it also gives her a lot more insight into what her gem is worth and and even just how to conduct herself at a market. So hopefully these skills can translate to other, you know, other activities as well, not just the gems and the mining.
I love you guys, Moyo gems. I guess Moyo means heart. Is that right?
Yes. In Swahili and Shona, I believe. So yeah. So it's gems from the heart, really trying to kind of, again, not just make it a product or commodity, but actually, you know, really attach the meaning to it as well.
Yeah. Imagine digging up a bag of tanzanite, you know, and not knowing the value of what you're selling or even how to identify it. I love that GIA started the education in that department. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And so it's that idea of building blocks of, you know, okay, now we have this education and now we've gone on to do even more there just because we have this amazing, we have these wonderful local partners in Tawoma and PACT Tanzania, and they are able to kind of help us sort of even delve into more value for the women. So for instance, Tawoma was trained by PACT, and that's through some generous funding of a few different foundations, but they're able to, it's called the Worth Program, and it is financial literacy for these women, because now they have these occasional windfalls of, you know, being able to sell their gems at this market, but they don't necessarily, there's not a banking culture. There's not really a lot of institutional knowledge of, you know, saving or how to reinvest in your business. And so even things like financial literacy, you know, we've tried to kind of, you know, cover that as well, because it's needed, and they have the building blocks already now of, okay, now they know what they're finding. They know how to bring it to market. Now they're selling it successfully. Now what's the next step? What's the next level?
Do you have a favorite experience that you had on these, one of these, what, 16 trips you mentioned? Do you have a story or two you could share about?
So many stories. But, but I think...
I bet. Standing on
the edge, and literally and figuratively. And this last... So COVID was definitely a, you know, a big disruption in everything all over the world. And so many people in our industry affected in so many ways. And I feel like we're still kind of catching up from that. But in early 2020, all of the international buyers left Tanzania and Kenya, where we do business. And it became more and more clear as the year unfolded that this was not going to be a quick thing, where we had all these plans in Tucson of 2020 to go back and do all these things. And now, like, there's nothing. So really frustrating and really troubling, because I mean, food insecurity, you get to food insecurity really, really quickly in this region. And so, so we were watching and trying to figure it out, and we actually managed to figure out a way for our local partners, PACT Tanzania and Tawoma, and my export broker, who's purchased, you know, many times on our behalf, to actually organized markets, what we called them, like remote markets, even though they were all in person. It was just us that we were not able to attend. But we conducted the market in precisely the same way. We just had our export broker buy on our behalf. And it managed to keep this community going. It managed to kind of keep putting money into this community at regular intervals so that they could survive COVID, because it was really, really challenging and extraordinarily challenging. And in the end, you know, we weren't able to travel until 2022. And so May of 2022, I got on a plane with my brand new employee, Chloe, whose first day on the job was going to Kenya, which is, you know, quite wow. a nice way to start her career, I guess.
Initiate.
Yeah. And so we went back to East Africa and conducted the first Moyo Market Day that is an expansion into Kenya. So that was a wonderful kind of success story because we'd always intended for Tanga, Tanzania to be a pilot and to be able to kind of roll this out to more communities. And so Kenya made a lot of sense because they're all Swahili speaking. The GIA training could be conducted. And again, we could kind of follow up from the GIA training and then actually do a market in Kenya. But when I got back to Tanzania, later in that trip, the women were like, "We need you to come to our mine, Monica. You must come." So we came, you know, we went to their mines. It's a women's cooperative mine located some distance from where we conduct the actual market days. But again, it's really important that we are in these communities because there's no transportation, there's no car. Asking them to take a 12-hour bus ride to the nearest town is really not, it's not an option. And it's why they've had so little access over the years. So we bring the market to them. But the mine is a short distance from the market. And we went and visited. And you can only drive so far. And then you have to hike in. And so we're hiking over the red dirt. And, you know, you're trying to avoid the acacia thorns and everything. And then we get to the mining area. And there's a fairly good-sized hole in the ground. They mine tourmalines and they mine rhodolites there. And from a distance, I can hear song. I can hear them singing. Mm. And they were welcoming us to the mine. And it felt like coming home after almost three years of not being able to visit. Wow. And they were so welcoming, huge hugs. They were so proud to show us what they were doing and what they had found. So I helped them sieve a little bit, and then I sat down and I helped them sort through it's a pile of, you know, the rock that they end up with after the sieving, the digging and then the sieving, and then, getting my hands dirty. And the welcome was so wonderful. And to be back there they are so appreciative of this link to the market. And they completely get it. These are very strong, smart, very savvy women. And so to walk a mile in their shoes, so to speak, is probably my favorite part of these trips.
You just gave me like major chills, like all over.
I'll have to send you the video clip.
I was going to say, was it appropriate to video?
Because we were jumping up and down on both sides. It was really... they had been asking me in no uncertain terms at previous, you know, remote market days, "Monica, you must come back. You must come. Karibu sana, you are very welcome." And so so it was really nice to go back and just to see some of the initial miners. You know, we started with like maybe 60 miners, and now there's maybe 400 or 500 that have been registered for the program just in this region. So there's been tremendous growth, but there are still the same women that we spoke to back in 2018 and that have kind of continued and show up at every market day with their gems. I buy what I can to support them, but also bring their beautiful gems to market. I mean, you can have the best story in the world, but unless they're actually beautiful, you know, right. it will only go so far. And when I use the word sustainable, which I almost never use because you can't really apply that to an extraction product that we have, but the business model is sustainable. Like I want it to continue to kind of grow and thrive. And just, you know, as I sell their gems, I come back, I buy more gems. And so from that standpoint, I want this to be sustainable.
Are you the only buyer, or there's multiple broker buyers over there doing the purchasing?
Yes. So there's several of us dealers internationally that kind of participate. So it's myself, Stuart Poole of 1948, and then Emmanuel Piet of Maison Piet, based in Paris. We all are the primary buyers. And then we kind of distribute those to the market.
Okay. Okay. Oh my goodness, Monica, we need like 5 hours to talk, but we don't have 5 hours, and that's okay.
That's okay.
Yeah, I just don't know how you're doing all of this, and I'm so, like, you're changing that whole culture, potentially. Not the culture. I know that that's one of the rules I talk with Tim McCrite about, you know, with the Toolbox Initiative, is they're very conscious about not in going and influencing the culture, or trying to shift or shake anything up in that direction, but honoring the needs and the, you know, like you're saying, the sustainability of the of making for a living or mining.
Yeah, and this is why it's really important to have dialogue and to ask them what they need versus I think there's a lot of charity fatigue. There's a lot of assumptions that have happened over time, this whole, you know, sort of white savior mentality. It's really important to engage in active dialogue and constantly iterate and reassess like what's working, what's not working. So it's it's a progression. It's a work in progress. And if it's not working for them, you know, then it doesn't work for us.
Right, right. Education, communication. Yeah.
All the things.
All the things all the time.
Yes.
Yeah. Monica is on also board of advisors for the BIJC, the new kind of a newer organization, the Black and Jewelry Coalition, International Board of Directors of Women's Jewelry Association. I'm understanding there's a new one, the Jewelry Industry Council, formed by Jewelers Mutual, who I just ran into those guys.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how do you do all the, you know, but like you said, just one day at a time, one thing at a time, and collaborate.
Yes. And yeah. There's, you know, with any of these,
and not to mention ethical metalsmiths, of course, we've got to fit that in. Everybody knows about this one. Yeah.
Yeah. So again, all of these organizations are teams and collaborative, and again, they overlap in many ways. So yeah, I've been president of Ethical Metalsmiths for the last almost 3 years. In fact, I'm nearing the end of my term, so that means that I will still devote a lot of energy towards various initiatives that we're working on. I just won't be president anymore. But it's really a community near and dear to my heart. I think when I joined the board in 2016, it was like, oh, you know, you find your people, right? People who are also working on responsible initiatives in really different capacities. And I think that's what's eye-opening, is it feels like there's a lot of little pockets of things happening all over the world. But occasionally, you know, you have this opportunity to kind of like come together, or whether it's virtually or in person, and realize like you're not alone. There's others working on incredible things as well. And I would say the thing that I value most about Ethical Metalsmiths, and I should note, like, I'm not a metalsmith, so it's clearly open to, you know, anyone, and is very inclusive in that regard. But it's really about community. It's about being able to kind of share ideas, resources, either, you know, whether that's receiving resources or sharing that with someone else. There's community forums, and there's ways to kind of connect with people both virtually and in person that just, again, kind of help you on. I like to think of responsibility as a journey. It's not like some magic checklist. It's not some, you know, title that you somehow earn, or just, and you also can't just say the words. You actually have to back it up and do the work. And so just having that ability to kind of understand you're not alone, it's about continuous improvement. And then there's this whole community of people that kind of help you. And I just find people to be extremely generous with their time and their resources to help things along.
It does take a village, doesn't it? Literally and figuratively.
For sure.
Yeah. For sure. We could do things by ourselves, but it's so much more powerful when you have like-minded people. I always say, surround yourself with people doing the things that you want to do or be. Community. It's the
community.
Word.
Community. Yeah.
The word.
And I was going to say too that Gem Legacy is, I'm also on the board of that organization. And my 10% in my business model of the give back was done a little bit more, I would say, ad hoc and kind of, you know, when I was there, you know, traveling a few years ago. But Gem Legacy has been around for about 3 years or so. And it gives me a vehicle to actually have that 10% go through a 501c3 that is working on initiatives, you know, again, the exact kind of things that I am interested in funding and in helping bridge that gap. So vocational training for gem cutting and, you know, scholarships for that and school lunches at a Maasai primary school that's located near a ruby mine in northern Tanzania. And so there's community development. So it's a lot of things that are I was already working on, but now this gives like an actual vehicle. So there's some really interesting initiatives there that people could check out. And you can fund specific initiatives that speak to you. It's very transparent, very nimble, small organization, and it's really focused on East Africa. We'd love to kind of see that expand, but right now, you know, we're able to kind of do some really good work on the ground there.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, you're answering all my questions, Monica, before I could. Where do I fit in? No, I love it. Thank you for sharing all of this with us. And I was going to ask, like, how can we get involved? And I loved reading Mwatate, the children's home.
Yeah, the Mwatate children's home is in a village that's really close to, it's kind of the jumping off place for the gem mining region around Voi, Kenya. So that's where all the beautiful severites come from and lots of garnets and tourmalines. And the orphanage probably exists because some of the parents have probably passed away from, you know, working in the mines or just kind of, it's not the easiest life around there in general. And so being able to support these kids and give them, you know, kind of like solar panels so that they can do their homework until later at night. And then there have been opportunities to send them on to secondary school, which is not paid for by the government. So just a way of giving back to that region in a way that's, you know, thoughtful and responsible and kind of tied to the mining community, even if it's a little bit indirectly.
Yeah, yeah. When I would imagine, and too, in my talks with Tim and Matthew, that a little goes a long way.
That is
a little goes farther there than it would here. Am I correct?
It makes a huge impact. You know, even small amounts. $25. I think it's $25 to $30. For instance, will feed a primary school child breakfast, hot breakfast, and lunch for a year.
What?
I know.
$25 for 1 year.
For 1 child. So now granted, you know, this particular school that we do this program at, there's, you know, 800 to 900 kids. So it does sort of, you know, cumulatively add up, but the impact is enormous.
And significant. Yeah.
And so for people looking to kind of give back, like there are a few different vehicles. There are different ways to do that. And, you know, I would just say, kind of like with anything, shop with your values, like what speaks to you, what resonates with you, how do you want to show up and give back? This industry has given a lot of people, I think in this country and Europe, really wonderful livelihoods. Like how do we also kind of just spread that goodwill and knowledge and access to others?
Absolutely. I love it. Is there, if there were a, I want to ask you this question I came up with last night, Monica. I want to ask everybody this question. If there were a top to the mountain that you're climbing, what would that look like?
That is a great question, Courtney. I definitely think you need to ask that from everyone.
I think I'm going to put it in, right? Yeah.
I like it. The reality is that like this work is never done, right? There's not some magic place where you get to. It's kind of like the checklist. Like it's never going to be done.
There's no top. We just keep climbing.
We just keep climbing.
Just keep climbing.
But I would say that, you know, at some point, the thread of continuity through all the things that I think I'm involved with is this idea of like equity, and care, you know, care for people, care for the environment. And again, people can show up in different ways for that. So the idea that we are all on this journey kind of together to kind of help each other up the mountain. And then eventually I would love it if, you know, we get to, you know, that scenic park bench and there's a bunch of us there and that the industry has enacted enough of kind of like a baseline of things that we're it's not, you know, it's not radical. It's not extraordinary to do these things, to think about kind of supply chain and your impact and what sort of impact you're having. But it's just how we operate as an industry. That would make me so happy if like some of these organizations didn't need to exist because we actually have gotten to that place where it's just the way business is.
Mm-hmm. I'm picturing the song, like, we're all holding hands on the top of the mountain, you know? I'm getting real visual here with it. And then the songs that you heard with your welcome, you know, in Swahili. Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. I love that.
Big sun, sunshine, you know, Painting the picture, Monica. Well, that's how we manifest things. It's how we make things happen, right?
That is my belief. And just keep climbing. Yeah, just keep climbing. Just keep, you know, I kind of have this analogy of like one foot in front of the other, like always. Like it, you know, from the beginnings of my business model to like what I'm working on today, you know, it all starts with one step, one thing. And that's all I can do. And I can't really worry too much about what other people think of that or how they react to that. I can't control that, but I can keep kind of moving forward just one step at a time.
Yeah. That's really all we can do is shift our own perspective or just keep moving no matter what, you know, is happening around you. Yeah. Which takes a lot of guts. I mean, it's, you know, I want to say it's ballsy. It is. I mean, it's just brave to kind of shut all that out and say, no, this is important. I'm doing this no matter what.
And, you know, we all have to look to inspiration of like what, you know, what actually, you know, keeps you going in those moments where you're like, oh, this is really, really hard. And for me, I think I was really thinking about this recently with International Women's Day and just thinking again, all I have to do is picture those miners, the Moyo Gems, you know, participants, and how resilient, how passionate they are about what they're doing. Many of them, even if they could choose to do something different, would still choose mining because it's so interesting to them and they're very invested. And so, you know, every once in a while, I'm like, okay, this is my inspiration. I choose to kind of put my eyes back on the Salmas and the Esters and some of the other women that I know.
Yeah. And that drives you. I think once we identify what lights us up and what's important to us, it's that's what keeps us going and moving forward, you know, putting that one foot in front of the other. So just keep moving, even through the sticky stuff and the hard and the red dirt and the thorns and all of the things. The heat, I would imagine.
Africa. There's definitely heat, but it is the most beautiful place and truly just incredibly welcoming, wonderful, gracious, gracious people. So I'll keep going back as long as they'll have me. So
that's awesome. Sounds like you're very, very welcome. And you're making a lot of opening a lot of doors that may not have been opened otherwise ever. So bravo to you, Monica. Thank you so much for sharing all this. We barely touched on the iceberg that is Monica Stevenson, you guys. We'll have to have her back again and again and again.
You're very kind.
Well, it's true. And I'm grateful there's women like you out there advocating for other women and advocating for these things that are important because not all of us have the skill set or the ability, like you mentioned, the tech ability mixed with this kind of artisanal understanding and the gemstone understanding. So you're using your powers for good.
Thank you.
It's all we can hope for, right, in life, is that we're using our powers for good, not evil.
we tell that to our children all the time.
Do you really?
Yes,
use your powers for good. Like good, literally that?
Literally that. So.
Oh, I love that. We're on the same page with that.
Yes.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with the community while we have a couple of minutes? I know.
I think I think we covered some good stuff.
We really
did. Unless you have something really outstanding you want to ask.
Well, I think we fit a lot in today, and I'm so grateful to learn more and to have the opportunity to sit with you today and share with the community, you know, all of the things. Where do we find out more? Where's the best place to go, or the places? There's quite a few.
So you can check out Anza Gems, ANZAGEMS.com. You can check out MoyoGems.com. You can check out gemlegacy.org, ethicalmetalsmiths.org, blackandjewelrycoalition.org. I don't know. There's one thing leads to another. So even if it's just one thing, that would be great.
Absolutely. Yeah, you guys dive in, and especially Moyo Gems, I found, have a lot of great, the story and how things tie together, but we'll definitely add links for you guys to follow up and get involved. I mean, $25, come on, let's feed a child for a year. Like, that would make me feel so good just to know that that's that one little thing that you could do. And also, I know that you guys can look into a way to, you can actually get listed as a maker that's using these gemstones, correct?
Correct. And with those gems, we can, like, we actually have that granular traceability just because of the way we do these market days to actually tell you who the miner was who brought it to market. So we're happy to help, always here to answer questions and tell our stories. It's less about sales and more about just kind of spreading the word and making sure that these voices get heard.
Yeah, community. Awesome.
Yes.
Exactly. Monica, thank you so much. Onward and upward with all of the work that you're doing. And thank you again for joining me today.
Thank you, Courtney. Thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in, you guys. I hope you have enjoyed this episode of For the Love of Jewelers. Stay tuned for the next episode by subscribing through Spotify, iTunes, or by searching podcast at riogrande.com. I encourage you to rate us, write a review, and share with friends and colleagues. I hope you're all finding ways to stay inspired. I'm your host, Courtney Gray. Until we get to connect again, onward and upward.